Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome back to The Midpoint. My guest today has presented some of the longest running and much loved shows on our televisions, including Blue Peter, The One Show and Countryfile. Matt Baker's affable nature beamed through the TV screen from the off and has secured his place in the nation's hearts. But did you know that Matt's presenting career all stemmed from a high school production of Grease? More on that later. Perhaps that explains why he was so great on Strictly Come Dancing, finishing runner-up in 2010. That and his background in gymnastics. Well, we got to know Matt and his family much more intimately when he returned to his parents' farm in the Durham Hills and filmed Matt Baker, Our Farm in the Dales. With a life outdoors in mind, our expert today is August Bernstein. August is head tutor at the Raymond Blanc Gardening School in Oxfordshire, and with gardening firmly on our radar as a way of improving well-being, August is going to give us some tips on how to make the most of our green spaces. But first, let's say hello to Matt Baker. Welcome to The Midpoint.
Thank you.
It's so lovely to have you here. I love having people in situ in the original Midpoint hut.
Yeah, it feels right, doesn't it?
Yes.
It feels personal.
Yes.
And it's an honour for me to come in and be where it all started. it does, it feels good. I like it.
Well, you're only down the road from me, but I haven't seen you for a very long time. And I feel like we need a good catch up about what's going on in Matt Baker's world.
Yeah.
I mean, I see you on the telly, obviously, a lot, and you look like you're really enjoying yourself. But before we get into kind of midlife exploits, I mentioned in your introduction your background, and I'd forgotten how you got your Blue Peter job.
Yeah, it was quite an event, really. Yeah, very ballsy, I suppose. And I never actually wanted to be in television, really, before I went for Blue Peter. And it was a challenge to try and get the job, do you know what I mean? And I think that's kind of how I've always been like that all my life. I sort of set myself these goals that seem almost unachievable, and then I work really hard to try and make them happen. And I've sort of like got two halves of me. One is like, here, see if you can try that. And then the other half goes, all right, then let's give it a go. And it was one of those situations where, do you want me to go? I don't know how much you mentioned in your introduction. Do you want me to go into how it happened?
Tell me the full story, you know, where you were in your life, what you were doing, and how you found out about the job.
Well, it sort of reverses back to when I was in a college production of the musical Grease to do some backflips and somersaults and sort of body double one of the guys that was taking the lead role. And so I went all the rehearsals, and the idea was, I wore exactly what he did and with the leather jacket and the hair and all that. And he walked off stage, and then I came on and did some backflips and jumped off the Grease lightning car and all of that. Anyway, things were going well. The rehearsals were going well. And 2 days before the show opened, he got laryngitis and he couldn't speak. And it was like, what we're going to do? And the teacher was like, well, you followed him around stage. You know all of his lines. Why don't you just do the part? And I was like, well, I can't really sing. And they were like, well, just give it a go. So I went home, spoke to mum and dad and said, what do you reckon? And they said, well, why don't you try it and see what happens? And I did. And it went really well. And all the teachers were like, look, you've got to stop doing the A-levels that you're doing and do theatre studies. And I thought, well, okay, but I want to be a physiotherapist, which because of my gymnastics background, that's what I really wanted. And I thought, well, listen, if I'm going to get good grades, then why not swap? So I was doing sports science, I was doing biology, and I was weirdly doing a classics A-level because my mates were. So I dropped the classics, then went for theatre studies, and one thing led to another, and I ended up getting scouted to go to drama school up in Edinburgh. Now, I'm dyslexic, right? So I'd never read a book before I went to drama school. Just because it was not easy for me.
Not and comfy, I wouldn't listen. Not enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah. So
and they didn't really do audiobooks the same way
then,
did they?
No. So Yeah, so I ended up randomly at drama school in Edinburgh because it was quite close to home. So it meant I could get back to the farm to, you know, help on weekends and what have you. And while I was there, my then girlfriend, who's now my wife, who weirdly is a physiotherapist, honestly, it's like some weird world when you reverse back through my life. Her auntie was looking at some TV magazines and she'd seen Stuart Miles was leaving the show. So she got onto Nicola and said, look, Matthew would be brilliant for this. So Nicola said to me, look, what do you reckon? And I said, it seems brilliant. I mean, it sounds like a perfect job. You turn up at 5 o'clock, you travel the world and do some amazing things. I'll give it a go. Then I thought to myself, how am I going to get this gig?
So you're at theatre school.
So I was at drama school, yeah.
In Edinburgh.
And I'd been there for a few months. Mm-hmm. And so I hadn't done any, hardly any training. Yeah. I'd done the bits on the balls where you bounce and then right. you learn to
you
be a tree.
You weren't doing
and stuff.
A fellow.
No. So I was like, right, I'll watch an episode of Blue Peter and I'll get the last name that comes up because that's obviously the head honcho.
Person.
Yeah. So I did that and I got his name, Steve Hocking. And I thought, I'm going to ring up directory inquiries and get the number for TV Centre down in London, as you do. So I got the number. I rang up main reception and I said, hello there, can you put me through to Steve Hocking, please? He knows I'm calling. And they did. They put me through to the office where I got through to his secretary, Claire. And I said, hi there, is Steve there, please? It's Matt Baker here. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, he's a bit busy at the moment. And I said, don't worry, I'll ring him back in 10 minutes. Went back through the whole process, got through to Claire again and did it 3 times. And she said, look, what is this regarding? And I said, look, I think I might be the next Blue Peter presenter. And she said, hang on. You know, she said, we've got all the people that we want to audition. It's all sorted. And I said, oh, so you're not going to give me a chance then? And she said, well, I said, what would I have to have done to get to this point? She said, well, you're not to send in your show reel. And I said, what's a show reel?
Thanks, Claire.
Said, yeah. It's all the things you've done in the past. I said, look, if I can get you my show reel by tomorrow, will you have a look at it? I said, what have you got to lose? Why not give me a chance? And she said, okay. And I put the phone down, shouted to me dad to get the video camera that we were making this show reel. We went off around the farm, filmed the most random clips you could ever imagine. Last thing I filmed was my telephone number on a piece of paper because we couldn't edit it. We just had to do one clip after another. And
you did a backflip on it?
I did it, yeah. I rode around the farm on a unicycle. I did some juggling. I did somersaults off the hay bales. Lambed a sheep, actually, which was, and I thought, the townies are going to love this. So I'm there with my hand up the back end of
it. That was lucky that it needed lambing.
Yeah, it was Easter time. That's why I was back on the farm.
That's 6 degrees of separation because you end up becoming a country file presenter then.
Well, yes.
Eventually,
yeah, exactly.
But so you get the Blue Peter job, you're now in telly,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you're down in the smoke, you're living in London. Mm. The boy off the farm in County Durham is down in London. And as we know, the career snowballs and becomes a very successful one, and particularly great at live telly as well,
which is
an art to do live
telly. I think, to be honest with you, Blue Peter is the most phenomenal training ground for any presenter, and certainly for somebody that loves and is interested in people and doing things. Do you know what I mean? And so, I used to love it when it went wrong. And I think that's the thing why, you know, some people fear live television because they're frightened that something's going to go wrong. But actually, as you know yourself, you don't really know what's going to happen anyway.
It's the best bit.
Yeah. You've got, I mean, it is literally, I mean, it's the joy of surfing, isn't it? That's why people love to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And climbing and all of that, because actually you can't work out your route before you start.
Yeah.
And you know where you're trying to get to. Mm. And all the fun and joy and everything that you can have. Mm. And that sort of, I don't know, I love the feeling of camaraderie in television and community and everybody together experiencing the same thing at the same time. And that's what you get in spades with Blue Peter. And I remember, you know, on those dark nights, it was like 5 o'clock and you just had this feeling of so many young viewers huddled around the telly and the doors would be open and you're about to drive in an ambulance or something like that. And you were just so excited.
Because it was in the massive studio at Television Centre, wasn't it? So that you could literally get a truck in there if you needed to.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, the stuff I drove in there, my word. I drove a Ford Model T in there. Ambulances, like I say, also. We got a fire engine in there. Yeah, all sorts of wonderful stuff. But yeah, Blue Peter was incredible. And it was at a time when foreign filming was so cheap that we were all over the world continually. I mean, there was 4 of us on there. And also, it was a time when...
Who were your 4 then?
Well, when I started, it was Katie Hill, Connie Hook, Simon Thomas, myself. And that's how it started. And then Liz joined. And then, to be honest with you, loads of people then came and went as we went through.
How many years in the end?
I did 8 years. And it was when the children's BBC channel started as well. So we were doing three times live, and then we were doing another two extra shows for the channel. So we were on five times a week, but we were literally either, you know, somewhere abroad in the morning, flying in and then coming straight in to do the live studio. And you're doing that in those early days. And the thing was as well, mentioning that when I came down from the farm in Durham, I really didn't get on. I didn't like it at all because it was a very different energy to the Durham Dales was, you know, Shepherd's Bush, which was where we were based. And
you were more of a shepherd than a Shepherd's Bush boy.
Exactly. I know. I remember going down there going, I can't believe it's called Shepherd's Bush. I imagined it very different than when I turned up.
You were kind of like a northeast version of Crocodile Dundee. A
perfect example. Yeah, perfect. But I used to sit with the editors on an evening because I didn't have any friends. And I mean, it's
I totally relate. I used to go jogging in Richmond, where I first lived when I came down to work for Sky from Newcastle. And I used to go for a jog on a Saturday night just so I could look in people's houses. They were having dinner parties and friends. And I used to like wander the streets pretending to jog.
Well, I had a bike and I used to ride up and down Chiswick High Road like a kid. You know what I mean? On a night, used to go out on my bike because it was like
because there was life out there,
something to do. But do you know what? That sitting there with the editors and just seeing how they were literally editing my films and what I was doing, what I could have done better, and how I could have been more helpful.
What an education!
Was brilliant, and I did that. Continued, and then as I got further on in my career with Blue Peas, I started directing the other presenters, which I really loved. And
did they mind?
I don't think so. No, I hope not. But that's what I loved more than anything. And I think even going, you know, talking about that live presenting, you're actually a producer. You're not a presenter. You're sort of packaging everything, aren't you?
Yeah, you've got to have. You can sit down with somebody who has a vision for the show and decide together how something's going to go. But at the same time, you're then in control of that. So you then have to be quite creative and on the hoof, I think, as well. And I think that you're very good at that because I think partly because of your dyslexia, actually.
I do.
Because you probably learnt everything, you know, pat, didn't you, off pat? And just,
you had to.
Yeah, so you weren't relying.
And I still have to be honest with you. And I don't know what it's like to not do that. I'm very, very rarely am I frightened of something because I can sort of rewind it back to sort of 5-6 years old and being asked to come out to the front of the class at school and read aloud. And for me, that was the most terrifying experience because, you know, I get on well with my dyslexia. I think it's a superpower. I love it. And if I lived my life again, I would definitely have dyslexia. But when I think back to those times, it was so frightening to try and do what other people were doing in the way they were doing it. I couldn't do it. And no matter how hard you try, you can't, it just doesn't happen. And so you become very kind of, I don't know, you just become immune to repetition. Mm-hmm. You're very used to keep just going and going. I have a very high tolerance for failure. Do you know what
Which
I mean?
Which is such a healthy thing.
Yeah. I don't see it as a negative failure. I just see it as the next stage in learning. And because when I was young, people didn't really know or really engage with it. I mean, my dad's dyslexic too, and I just sort of assumed that life was kind of tough like that. And my mum used to do all the writing for my dad. And I sort of grew up with that. And my wife, Nicola, is brilliant at knowing like when to help me and when to sort of like leave me be. But it's something I've really come to terms with, and I really enjoy it now. And I think I'm at that stage in my life where I can look back and see how I've sort of achieved what I've achieved.
Partly through that and the way that your brain works. And I also think that, you know, because Kenny's exactly the same, you know, he would say the exact same thing about being a 5-6 year old. He used to punch himself in the head in front of the mirror because he thought he could knock himself into being able to read. And he didn't understand. People didn't understand. School didn't understand, particularly at that time. It was only post-school that he realised what it was. But he would never have even thought of going into formal education. He didn't sit one public exam. You know, he left before he even did one. Very similar to you, on a farm, had that satisfaction of being able to go outside and do something really purposeful.
Yeah.
You know, build something on the farm, deliver something on the farm, which you did, which is really interesting, actually, I think, that those parallels, because without that, without the farm, had you been just a dyslexic kid with no outlet, your experience might have been very different.
It would
the
have
frustration
been.
Frustration would have been different.
Yeah, and it fed that practical side of me. And, you know, when you grow up on a farm, you become very independent. If you're out and you see something that's, you know, if there's a sheep with its head stuck in the fence or whatever, you don't go all the way back to the house to go, oh, there's it. You sort it out. Mm. You know, if there's a leaking water trough, you try and repair it. And you become very sort of like quite resilient or quite, you're into problem solving and you're always looking for something that's wrong as well, weirdly, on a farm. You know what I mean?
Well, because if you catch it early, it's going to be less of a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Kenny's dad used to say to them, right, this tractor's not working. Mm. Obviously, they try and fix it. We're going to get somebody out, all of you here to watch him because we're never getting him out again.
Yeah, totally.
And so they'd all have to, and the poor guy fixing it would probably think, well, I've got an audience of five.
Yeah.
But he was like, that's never happening again. We're never paying somebody else to do this.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because, yeah, you become a plumber, you do bits of electric, you do all, you're certainly a carpenter. There's no doubt about it. You do a lot of work like that. And I love that. And that's actually a big part of what I like in life as well. I love DIY. I love building, you know, any work there is to do at home or whatever. I'll always do it first and then we'll get someone in if it needs to, or if it goes wrong or whatever. Yeah. But I'll definitely try.
So all those practical skills would have been brilliant on Blue Peter and even your understanding of the countryside on Countryfile. You spent 9 years on the one show?
I did, yeah.
And
9 years.
Not as much use for your practical side there. Your live telly side, clearly, but it's not a show where you're hands-on.
Do you know, it was interesting, actually, because I was part of the pilot week for the one show right in the early days when they were actually creating
it as a
format.
Well, we did it for 3 weeks together. Do you remember when they changed their presentation
team?
Yes, you were involved even before
it was commissioned. And what I did was I was hanging out of helicopters and I was down with the RNLI right on the south coast, jet skis, all sorts. And we did these quite ambitious, actually, full-on live broadcasts with me on the end of literally a rope being winched out of the air sea rescue. And I was meeting everybody and talking to them. And it was on beaches and on boats. And then it got commissioned. So, and then I used to sit in occasionally, off and on in the
really
studio. So they
didn't follow that kind of train then, in terms of...
not really,
they didn't really do many of those films, did
they? Maybe in the early days, it sort of happened a little bit, but not really. Then what happened was it came off the back of Strictly, actually, did my appointment on The One Show. And I was already doing Countryfile and that was going great guns. And, you know, I wasn't really that up for being on The One Show. And the then head of BBC One, Danny Cohen, got me in and said, look, sit in for a week and see how it goes. And I was like, yeah, it's really busy. You know, I'm full on at the moment with doing Strictly and everything. So when I was doing Strictly, I was doing The One Show, Countryfile and Strictly. And
How did you get to the final?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I don't know. God knows.
So it was a really rich time in your career.
Yeah, it really was. And then, and it was the time when Adrian Charles was leaving. Mm. And that was why I was going in and out, just a bit of kind of familiarity, I suppose. And then Adrian left and Jason Manford was given the role on The One Show. And I was quite happy to go back to Countryfile. And one thing led to another. Jason left and then they rang me up and said, look, would you do it full time? And I said, look, I don't know if I can because I'm obviously doing Countryfile. How is it going to work? And they said, well, we'll shift the whole of the edit schedule of Countryfile. And because we filmed it at the start of the week and it went out on the Sunday. They said, we'll shift it all so that you can shoot it all on a Friday, do one show Monday to Thursday, shoot it on a Friday, and then we'll edit it and put it out the following week. And I was like, okay, I'll try it for 6 months and see what happens. And then I just carried on with that schedule for 9 years.
Wow.
And I don't know, I just sort of sat there and never left for nine years. And I never thought to myself, I desperately want to work on this show and I desperately want to do it. And I did it for 9 years and I met some brilliant people. And then the same people come around again and you think to yourself, do you know what? I can be doing more with my time than sitting here every night.
When you left though, because when you're in a show like that and you're doing something where you're in the same place, seeing people and, you know, in a team, even if you want to leave or even if you think there's more exciting stuff for you to be doing, it's very hard to take yourself out of those routines, isn't it? Did you feel at all that you'd been a bit institutionalized and that you were...
Maybe a little bit, but it was that sort of that part of me again saying, look, you know, was this ever a goal? And what are you actually working towards? And, you know, you think to yourself, well, I'm doing this chat show at 7 o'clock on BBC One. Like, does the goal then become, I'm just going to do this forever? What is the point of continuing with something that you've done for 9 years?
How old were you when you left?
I'm 42. I'm 46 now.
So kind of, you know, for this audience, a lot of people are thinking about I want to get out of this.
Yeah.
I don't want to, but it's safe and it's, you know, how did you spin that in your mindset? Was there any sense of insecurity?
Or well, I thought I'm going to, well, I haven't left Country File, so I thought I'm going to keep that going if I'm going to, you know, and then I thought I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to go because if I don't, I will probably be here forever. And I, like I said before, I loved that element of production. I loved the element of directing. And I thought, I really want to set up my own production company. And I've done that now with a really good friend of mine who was the then head of development for BBC Studios. Yeah, Gareth Collett. And he left just before me. And we've been talking for years.
So you kind of ran out together and into the brave new world.
And we thought, let's give it a go. And it's been brilliant. It's been amazing. And I mean, it's really tough at the moment in the world of commissioning and TV programs and all that because everybody's viewing habits have changed dramatically.
But having said that, you've had a hit.
Yeah, we've had quite a few, to be fair. It's gone incredibly well. And the first one that we did was Our Farm in the Dales, which, you know, I'd never, ever thought of putting my family on television. In fact, I've been incredibly protective of them over the years.
Very private, haven't you?
And never, exactly. And I never really wanted to sort of bring them into it in any way, shape or form. And what happened was, and it was kind of just before COVID, and Mum had this really nasty accident. I'd left the one show and she had this accident literally like weeks later. My dad rang me up and said, yeah, your mum's broken her leg. She's in a really bad way. And I mean, I cannot, honestly, when I think back, it's horrific what could have happened. She was down the sheep pens. Unbelievably, there was somebody with her, which there never really is usually. Mm. And she was getting the sheep ready for shearing. And the gate burst open. One sheep sort of ran through and then the rest of the flock followed. And my mum was in the way and she basically got trampled on by the flock. They weren't trying to hurt it. They were just running. And she was on the ground and then they all went over. And like I say, thank God somebody was with her. And she got rushed off to hospital. I mean, she was out cold, so goodness knows. Anyway, my dad, who's not incredibly mobile now, was in a right state and what have you. And we were straight away, we were like, okay, we're going to come back. We're going to just assess the situation. And we got back and we'd been waiting for a long time for something to go wrong, you know. And it gets very nerve-wracking, I suppose, when you get to this phase in your life when your parents are getting older and you know what they're doing is really practical and quite full-on as a lifestyle. They never wanted to leave the farm, but it was getting very demanding. And you try and have conversations, but, you know, parents being parents, we're doing what we're doing and we're happy with the way it's going and all of that. And you're like, okay. And then this event happened and it was quite obvious to my mum straight away that things needed to change. And so we decided to change the farm up. You know, I had more time. I could do that. I could be there. I could look at the whole infrastructure and think, right, if mum and dad want to do this going forward, what is the most sustainable way? What's easy for them to keep? And we reversioned the entire farm. So that it was, you know, easy to run. It was an unbelievable time. And we were busy with ideas for TV and lots of remote sort of, you know, Zooms and all of that with commissioners and channels. And one of them, I was down in the sheep pens and I couldn't get that. I had to jump on the call early. And it was with the commissioner for Morfort. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. It's all kicking off here. It was similar to that weird video that I did for Blue Peter. And he said, well, would you ever think about filming something like that? And I was like, well, not really, you know. I've always kept my family private. I said, let me have a chat with my parents and see where we're at. And so I had a chat with them and they said, look, you know, if you're going to make a show that is heart and soul you, that you know all about, then there's nowhere better to do it than this. Mm-hmm. And there's a real story going on. There's a real family thing happening. So why don't we document it? So we said, well, let's do a little pilot, see how we go. And I invited some friends over. You know, as you know, we get very friendly with our crews and people that we can trust and know. And it was a very small team. There was me, basically, a lad called James Anderson, who's a brilliant cameraman, and Steve Atherton, who I'd known since Blue Peter days, and he was a sound man. And I said to mum and dad, I said, look, I'm going to get Steve involved because we did a lot of filming on the farm for Blue Peter. And I said, look, Steve's going to come and do the sound. What do you reckon? My dad was over the moon. I couldn't wait to get Steve up and chatting again. And we just filmed what happened. And I thought, you know what, Morfort, it'll be a little channel. I said, you know, it's a lovely audience of, you know, not many people will see this, but the people that do are lovely. And I'm happy that that's where it's going to live. And sure enough, it went on there. And I was expecting it to get maybe 150,000 viewers. 1.8 million people watched the first episode. And it became this, like, people just loved it. Mm. And they loved what we were doing. They loved why we were doing it. And although we were doing it to the backdrop of a farm, I think many families go through that chapter
change,
that we were
yeah.
in.
Well, the changes that you as a family, suddenly you've got your own kids, but then you're looking at your parents.
This is
and
it.
How can we help 100%. Their lives? And
that was that for me is the biggest thing. And certainly the arrival of in that sort of midlife chapter is that you start looking after your parents in the same way that they looked after you. Mm. And it's like, how do you look out for them? What can you do? How can you be helpful?
Well, you gave them also, I imagine, great joy, because being part of that and being a success must have been lovely for them.
Yeah. And they've been such a big part of it. And it's lovely, actually. And it's quality time. Do you know what I mean? It really is. And we have so much fun filming together. And now we do another little series, which is called Travels with Mum and Dad, where we take them off around the Northeast.
You're in a big Winnebago style.
Well, we take a cat. Well, actually, it's a caravan from the farm that we did up on our farm in the Dales. And do you know what? The joy that you can have spending time with your parents when you're at a different stage in life, I think is really wonderful, because, you know, you're at the stage of life that they were at when you were little. And it's amazing. And those, the generations and grandchildren and you being sort of in the middle of that, I love that. I love watching my children with my mum and dad.
Yeah, their interaction. It's really lovely. And it's, you know, if you're lucky enough to have your parents alive and your children at the same age, it's such a lovely, lovely thing, isn't it, to see?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Nicola, your wife, she's also having something of a midlife shift. You mentioned before that she was a physio.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, clearly, a secret writer.
Yeah, well, she's written all of her life. And it's amazing how, you know, we are in many respects chalk and cheese. Like, I cannot read, and she never stops reading. Do you know what I mean? It's like these weird sort of magnets that attract you together. I suppose it's similar for you and Kenny, that you know, because you're so kind of academic and in that respect. And
quite different people.
Yeah, totally. And ever since I've known Nicola, she's written and written and written. She's done it as a hobby. And when she was younger, you know, talk about a swot. I mean, she's quite similar to you in that respect, Abby. It's that, you know, she does her own work. And the thing, her exams when she was at GCSE were given as the example of how you do an English exam.
Really?
Right. Unreal. Anyway, she sort of followed physio, went through medical, did all that kind of stuff. And she was really into it and she progressed well, but she never stopped writing. But I mean, we have got like novels coming out of our ears at home, like that she's written. And when we started
but
doing
all
our
purely for her own at this point in yeah, not, until not, now, these yeah, were always for her own.
Not showing
benefit,
it. Just family and friends, you know, she'll write stuff and you know, people read it and it's brilliant. I mean, really wonderful stuff. And not that I'd ever read them. Yeah,
they sound great. That sounds like a great idea, love. But she's got herself a book deal.
Yeah, she has. And she's written about what people are really latched onto in our farm in the Dales. Yeah,
so
she's doing
her
four
characters
books.
Are based on a farm, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a young girl called Ava whose parents, they go abroad. They're part of medicine and they go off to sell some stuff in America. And she ends up living on her auntie and uncle's farm. And she goes and it literally is a voyage of discovery as she's literally for the first time experiencing these things and realizing that she's got a real gift for it and a real love for it and a real passion for it.
So she's a city girl that kind
she
of
she is a yeah, city girl yeah. yeah and she'd been out and visited the farm a few times at Christmas and all of that, but when she was there permanently, that was it. And book launch has already happened with one, which has just started. And then
give it the full title.
It's called The Whistledown Farm Adventures. Oh, and book one is finding hope. And it's not too much of a spoiler to say that hope is a little lamb that she finds.
Because finding hope sounds like some kind of like Mills and Boone, doesn't
it?
So, okay, as in, I was thinking it sounds quite adult, but hope's actually a lamb.
Hope is a lamb.
Right, okay.
And the Whistledown Farm Adventures is the whole kind of arc.
And it is Nicola Baker.
Nicola Baker, yeah. And she's each book is a different season. And this sort of loosely based on Nicola's experiences, because she has had no farming like upbringing at all. She always lived in sort of rural villages and what have you. But when she first came to the farm and met mum and dad for the first time, we started going out with each other. Then so she's sort of taken those experiences and
used
them.
That's amazing. So again, another brilliant example of a midlife shift.
Yeah.
And what do you think gave her the confidence then to go from having, you know, the books there for her own enjoyment and writing for her enjoyment to having the confidence, I think it is, isn't it, to share it with a wider world?
Yeah, I think, well, because she was very focused on our children, you know, being a mum and all of that, and she stopped doing physio to raise them. And then when she thought to herself, I'm going to get back into doing something to keep myself occupied, do I want to go back to physio or do I want to follow my passion?
Mm.
And I was like, well, you've got to try that first. You cannot not try it.
Mm.
And then if it doesn't work out, then you've always got physio to fall back on.
Because the kids are how old now?
So Luke will be 17 on his next birthday.
I cannot believe he's 17. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I know.
Right.
And Molly will be 15 soon.
So of course she was looking ahead thinking, there's an empty nest coming soon. Mm. I'm going to have to look at what I'm going to be doing with my life.
And I think that's the other thing with midlife is that your children become so capable that you're not needed in those same ways anymore. Mm. You become you'll cheer from the sidelines. You become the biggest supporter, but you're not needed in the same ways.
No.
And so what
it's
are you going to do
less
in that time?
Practical. It's much more emotional, in a different kind of emotional crutch, I think.
Yeah. But I mean, and then hopefully Luke soon will be driving and then that'll mean that he'll be able to take Molly around and then suddenly,
less practical.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, go for it. And she did go for it. And she said, look, I'm going to do this properly. I want to try and get an agent and do all of that, which she did. And and she's flying now and she's, and it's done her so good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just to do something.
You see a different woman.
I do. Yeah. I do actually. Yeah, I do. It's brilliant. And I'm so excited for her and I'm so proud of her. We're going on James Martin together, which is going to be hilarious.
Well, we were trying to get her to come in here, but it was only then that we discovered that we had a limited guest allocation for this.
She's sitting in the car. She's fine.
I need a third mic, you see. But we do have our expert always remote on these episodes. And it seems like a really good time to bring her in because not only is she somebody who could tell you how you can get going when it comes to being a gardener, domestic gardener, we're not talking the farm here, but her story, I think, will resonate in lots of ways in terms of a midlife shift. So it's hello to August Bernstein.
Hi, August.
It's been so lovely to hear your story. I think I really kind of connect with so many things that you were saying. And so I was actually...
August, just before you start your story, right now, just tell everybody what your job is right now.
So right now, I'm the head tutor of the Raymond Blanc Gardening School at Le Manoir, which is a 2 Michelin star hotel and restaurant in Oxfordshire, which to me, it's just like walking into heaven.
It is the most beautiful, beautiful place. It is stunning. And as I understand it, I've had the good fortune to eat there once. A lot of the produce that grows comes from the gardens there, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So we have 27.5 acres in total. Our main production area is about 1.5 acres. And I get to be, I think for me, the beauty is that you get to be a part of that artwork on the plate at the end of, the guest's experience, because I've sown that seed and then you get to pick that vegetable, take it up to the chefs, and then the chefs work their magic and it comes out something completely different. And it's just being a part of that process, I think, is just incredible.
But you didn't always do this. You weren't somebody who spent your childhood and your teenage years and your 20s growing plants and vegetables.
Oh, no. I think I would say up until 6 years ago, I had only probably grown a cress head at school, and that was about it. So if you'd have said to me 5-6 years ago, you will be teaching Raymond Blanc's favourite vegetables and working together with Raymond Blanc, doing festivals, talking to people about gardening and being this passionate about carrots, I would have laughed you down the aisle.
Because you were an air hostess.
Out the emergency exits. Yes. So I was... I was an air hostess for 20 years. Wow. And had absolutely no interest in gardening. I was that person that said, I touch a plant and it dies.
What happened? Tell us what the moment was then.
So I started sowing a few seeds with my children, and it kind of was just like this magic moment. I know when you have your friends over for dinner and you've created a lovely meal, but the act of putting a seed in the ground, watching it grow, and then walking out into the garden and picking that is just like a whole nother level. It's like, not only have I cooked this, but I've grown it as well. And then also seeing the connection with my children and the way that their relationship with food changed. So going from, on a Saturday, they want to eat Cocoa Pops, but on a Saturday, they were saying, Mummy, can we go out and pick sugar peas? And I think, oh my goodness, I've nailed parenting. This is amazing. So I think that was very much the beginning of this kind of change. And the more I gardened, the more I saw my children growing from it, the more I started realizing, you know, I'm traveling all over the world. You know, I didn't understand recycling and things like that. It wasn't really in my world. So the more I was working with nature outside in the garden and growing, the more my connection with plants, animals, and understanding the sort of interrelationship.
The ecosystem, the way we all connect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and realizing what I'm doing is having an impact out there, and then learning more and more and more. And I slowly but surely went down a rabbit hole, and my gardening book started like up to the ceiling. And then I went to Le Manoir for lunch, and I walked into the vegetable garden and cried because I thought it was the most beautiful garden. I am quite an emotional being.
It is, but, though, you know, it is the most incredible garden, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. There's like these beans are dripping from all the teepees. There's pumpkins overflowing onto the pathways. And I just felt like I was in vegetable heaven. And I'd had a couple of champagnes, so I went up to reception with a bit of Dutch courage and
hang on, this sounds like Matt Baker.
But this is how you do it. Yeah, this is what you get a dream and just go for it. Go and ask the person at the top, go for it.
So you went up to reception. I love this.
I asked for a job, and obviously they don't give drunk people jobs, so it was a bit of a no at that point.
They said, can you sober up and come back?
And then I went off to San Fran. So I got on a flight, as I did every week. And I mean, I don't know if you're sort of traveling a lot. Sometimes you wake up in a hotel room and think, where am I? And for some reason, I thought, I'm going to Google gardening jobs. So I Googled kitchen gardener. And really weirdly, the first job that came up was a kitchen gardener at Le Manoir. And no. It was so bizarre. And I had the head gardener's business card in my purse for when they tried
Popped
to get rid
off.
Of me out of reception. And I phoned and just said, there's a job. Is there any chance I could come for an interview? And obviously, as an air hostess, I didn't really know what to wear for an interview as a gardener. So I turned up with all my hair in a bow, makeup, nails, and the whole garden team looked at me like, what on earth is this girl doing?
Not a sight of a welly.
No, I don't think I even knew what wellies were.
That's brilliant.
And then, yeah, somehow I slipped under the mat, and it's kind of fueled my obsession. So really, I then started learning in the kitchen garden, did 3 years in the kitchen garden, and then just really focused on learning as much as I could. So I started my qualifications in horticulture, and then I got the opportunity to teach the school. So now I run about 100 different days a year, from cut flowers, vegetable growing, just really trying to connect our guests with that beautiful garden seed to plate experience.
So I thought I was having you on the midpoint, August, to tell people how to start their own vegetable garden. But actually, you've reinforced in a way a lot of what Matt says about following passion, but also being brave and going and asking the right people, you know, to help, reach out to somebody who can help you, which is brilliant. So you've, you know, there's a lot of synergy between your stories.
In general, people love to help other people. And if you give somebody the opportunity to help you, they will take
well,
you
it's
up
very,
on it.
It's a lovely feeling to help people,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So, and if somebody comes up to me and says, can I have your help with this? And you go, yeah, And then, so don't think you're the weird one for asking for help. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think I really resonated with what Matt said. Like, I couldn't even pick up a PA on the aircraft and say, will the passenger in seat 4A please make themselves known to the cabin crew? I would hide under a seat. I wouldn't want to, you know, be that person. Whereas now I teach at festivals to hundreds of people because I'm so passionate about what I do. And it's built, for me, I've got so much confidence from finding that thing that I love to talk about. I mean, I could talk about carrots all day long, but I wouldn't have recognized myself previously.
Tell us that. I'm thinking I'm going to do this from a very selfish and self-interested point of view, right? We have got some beautiful raised beds with weeds in them. We've tried a few times, right? My husband is very practical and he does a lot of stuff, but he's always too busy outside to get going on those beds. And we regularly say, we must be growing something, right? So I'm talking to you now, March. Can anything be put into the ground at the moment? What's the best thing to be growing?
This is quite possibly the best time to start. I mean, I think, like you said, the weeds are, that's something you have to just keep on top of. So I would say,
there's nothing else. It's just weeds.
Get rid of all the weeds. Yeah. And another big thing is you need to make sure that you fed your soil, because your soil is the most important part of growing anything. So have you put any compost in there in the last
year? Oh, we've got loads of compost. So? Loads.
Oh, perfect. So that's good. So just a nice thin, well, I'd say at least an inch of compost that will feed your vegetables and give the flavour and the nutrients. But now you can be sowing things like radishes, beetroot, spinach, lettuce. I mean, I think even things like lettuce, if everybody could just grow lettuce, if you think about the amount of packaging that we're reducing, it's such a, and the emissions from traveling through supermarkets. And it's
honestly,
so
don't get me started on that.
I'm thinking of taking scissors to the supermarket, you know, and just cutting everything there and say, you know, like leaving them in the pile, because it's, I buy loose. But
yeah. Why do they give us all this stuff that we really don't want? And the other thing is, as you say, in August, the joy of what you do is seasonal. Like, how come supermarkets have created a world when we walk in and go, oh, no, we can't have an avocado? Mm. It's like they've created that problem. It's weird.
It's
like,
so
they've
sad.
Created this world. It's like we walk in and expect all this stuff. Mm. No, what you get is certain foods at certain times of year, and you have a lot of joy in eating those foods.
When you get the first English strawberry of the season.
Totally.
And also, you can get so many great frozen vegetables if you really want those, you know, things at other times of the year. So if they're frozen in the summertime, some raspberries, whatever, you can get all those, can't you? So August, let me go through that again. We've got lettuce, we've got beetroots, radishes. What was the other one?
So we've got lettuce, beetroot, radishes, spinach. Spring onions. I also love edible flowers. Now, if you haven't grown edible flowers before, that is something that, and there's so many out there. So violas.
That's very Le Manoir-ish.
It is. But I just kind of sprinkle them on top of a salad and just make like a rainbow salad. Even things like dahlia petals, they're edible. So you can just put them into a salad and it just kind of changes the look of the dish. Also micros, so you can be sowing sort of micro herbs on your window. So there's probably a lot of people out there that think, well, I don't actually have a garden. What can I be growing now? And things like, you could do lettuce on the windowsill, pea shoots. I mean, pea shoots are just so fantastic and so easy to grow. You just literally sprinkle your peas into a pot. And also, I think another tip that I kind of try and give to people is to look at your rubbish. So you don't necessarily need to go to the garden centre and spend loads of money on pots. I use things like, I've got some here. So for example, sow my peas into toilet rolls. I mean, most people have the toilet roll tubes. Mm-hmm. If you don't, I don't want to be your friend, because that's very...
What's going on in your house? So you sow those into the tubes.
Into the tubes. And then the other thing is, you can then just plant the toilet roll straight into the ground, and then it will biodegrade into... So you're reducing your packaging.
Have you done these things on Countryfile?
This is a Blue Peter item. This
is this one? Yeah.
Come on, we're talking toilet roll
it's
tubes, are you?
I grew earlier. think I need a badge, actually.
Yeah, you get a badge for that, that's for sure. Well done.
And I guess as well, you've mentioned your kids, August, and everybody listening to this will either have kids or they know people with kids. We've got to try and encourage children to get involved and interested, haven't we, in this and where their food comes from, understanding that. I had a great day at Liverpool once with them, Jurgen Klopp, kind of following him around for the day. And the person he wanted to introduce me to most was this woman called Mona, who he'd nicked from Bayern Munich. She was the nutritionist. And he said, I want you to go and have lunch with Mona, this amazing German woman. And she wanted to introduce me to the chefs. And then they wanted to tell me all about the allotments that they made the apprentices go and grow. So 16-year-old footballers were made to go and grow their own vegetables, because a lot of them turned up not knowing that a carrot came from the ground and not knowing where their potatoes came from. And so, and that's
actually not their fault. This is what you have to know, is that a lot
I'm not trying
to
belittle them.
But what
I loved was the educational piece that a Premier League football club of, you know, which is currently top of the Premier League, has got that kind of understanding.
But also the appreciation that you then have, if you decide not to keep growing your own food, the appreciation that you have for those that are growing your food. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you understand why food costs what it does and that you shouldn't actually walk in and be able to buy some food for pence. You'd think, actually, how much time and effort would I be putting into producing this
food?
If I had
to start from scratch on this.
Yeah.
Whether it's a chicken or a beetroot.
And that food appreciation is something I think, again, that you really do get when you get to midlife. You start to think, hang on a minute, if I'm going to put the hours in to produce these carrots, like, why am I buying them for this? You know what I mean?
And you understand how farmers, you know, are finding it very, very hard, which I was going to come on to you and talk about actually in a bit.
But yeah.
August, thank you so much. Such an inspiring chat from the point of view of having a midlife pivot, which you did successfully. I don't think I've had one quite as dramatic as that, or heard, you know, going from air hostess to teaching at the gardens of Le Manoir is absolutely brilliant. Yeah, and your passion for it is coming through the screen talking to you. So thank you so much. You've inspired me to get going. I'm definitely going to, I'm going to say that right here, I'm going to at least go for some lettuce. Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so
Fantastic.
Much, both of you, for having me.
Thanks for coming on.
Happy spring. Happy spring to you, August. Happy spring.
I'm so ready for it now. Thank you.
That's lovely.
Bye. Yeah, bye.
I'll weed your raised beds on the way.
Weeding them is not the problem. We'll get out there and do it. But we've tried a couple of times. In fact, to tell you when there was going to be a potato shortage before Christmas a couple of years ago.
You just thought, this is the time.
Kenny was going, I can't not have roast potatoes at Christmas. So I went on Amazon, I think, to try and buy, you know, potato seeds. I didn't even know what you should be planting in the ground.
Yeah,
and then that made me realise my lack of education in that area is woeful.
It's really. This is the thing. It's not difficult, actually. It's just going for it.
Mm.
It's the decision of doing it. It's
and
like,
being,
you know,
responsible for that plant then, as much as you would be if you had an animal or you're looking after some livestock. So I was about to talk to you there, or it reminded me, I wanted to talk to you about Clarkson's Farm has actually, although it's an entertainment vehicle, has actually shone a spotlight on just how hard farming is and just how difficult it is to make money in farming, and how important subsidies are for farmers in terms of encouraging them to do various things with their fields and what they should be doing in terms of rotating their crops and educating people, I think, in a way that a country file does this brilliantly as well, obviously. But I think because it's kind of been through a slightly different angle, it's people have gone, oh, God. Because country file, I think, attracts an audience that's already interested in a way, doesn't it? It's already people who are vested a bit into the countryside.
And actually it's not a program for farmers. It's a program to engage people with what's going on in the countryside. Mm. And actually, if it's a starter for 10 and it gets you involved, I mean, I think we could go a lot stronger on the farming side of it, because I really do feel that people are interested. In fact, I know they are from what we've done on our farm.
Because used to be, back in the day,
it was a rural news program is what it was.
You know, Kenny said the family used to all gather around. Yeah. It was almost, that's where you get your updates.
100%, John Craven was there leaning on the bonnet of his Land Rover going, here's the rural news for the week. And then when it moved to its evening slot at sort of 7 o'clock, it turned into this lifestyle type program. And that's when I started presenting it and brought what I'd been doing on our farm, you know, with Blue Peter into that kind of family audience. But do you want it to be a warm bath, or do you want people to go, actually, I totally understand the you know, the difficulties that are going on here. So I think
Sunday at 7 o'clock, it's more of a warm bath, isn't it?
But it's so important that we as Britain totally engage with our food producers. And we're going through a really interesting time at the moment, you know, after Brexit, and we're sort of reshaping our agricultural policy. And it turns out that what's happening now is that England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, they're all coming up with their own different systems of how to encourage farmers, because there's no doubt about it. We want to farm in a sustainable way that's going to make, you know, make our land, as we were saying there with soil, it's so important. You know, how do you make our land fit for future generations? But that is a really difficult challenge when you're talking about rural economy and family businesses and all of that. So, you know, in this transitional period, it's a real challenge of how you are going to encourage farmers to farm in a more sustainable way. If you're going to reduce your stock numbers because it's too heavy on the land, what does that actually mean? What's the bottom line from a business perspective? And how are we going to create viable businesses that we're going to be able to pass on to the next generation and keep people in the countryside? Because it's so important. Do you know what I mean? If you say, oh, there's no money in that, I'm going to head off into the city. Well, that's no good, is it, on the grand scheme of it?
No.
So we've got to find ways of really supporting British
and all those
farmers.
Skill sets that we've talked about, the practical skills. There's so many different jobs that only exist in the countryside.
Totally. And actually, these days, you know, with the technology and everything that's happening, there's a lot of wonderful stuff that's happening in the industry that you can get involved. Even if you don't have a farming background, you can bring all of your technological skill to say, look, we could do this, we could do that, we could do the other. Have you thought about this way?
Don't get me going on Kenny and combine harvesters.
Yeah.
He said, you know, nowadays, obviously, it's all GPS, isn't it? And how they operate is very much kind of, you know, via satellite.
And the analysis that you can do on the soil, and you can map it so that you know what a certain area has from a nutrient perspective, and you can literally mix fertilizer that's perfect for that spot. And then the cocktail changes as you go around the field.
That's incredible.
It is. It's absolutely
so you're
remarkable.
Maximizing, you're utilizing every single square inch of that land.
Well, that's farming more efficiently, you see. So you say, well, what other areas can we do? But basically the situation we're in right now is trying to produce a sustainable farming system that is going to create good business as well for our farmers for the future, and it's up in the air at the moment. And so there's a lot of, you may have seen on the news, the Welsh farmers, what they're going to do. There's a lot of people going to come out of the rural economy, and that we're going to reduce numbers of livestock, they're going to reduce job numbers, and there's a bigger incentive to plant more environmental and trees and stuff like that. And farmers are taking land out of food production at the moment and putting it into the environment.
But
so where's the line?
Still get the food. Yeah, well, where do we get the food from? And then on the next page in the newspaper, or, you know, on the website, whatever you're reading, there'll be a story about obesity and foods which are highly processed and causing problems for us, for our health as a nation. So, you know, so
yeah,
this is not joined up thinking, is it?
No, the best way to be as healthy as possible and to be as environmentally friendly as possible is to eat local and eat what's in season.
And eat as close to nature as you can in terms of the product looking like what it was originally grown.
Yeah, just eat natural foods that are grown locally and they don't come from halfway around the world. Do you know what I mean? Whatever your diet is, if you eat lots of vegetables, if you eat meat, whatever, British farmers grow your food. We can supply your food and you can eat it at a choice, or you can decide to go into a supermarket and buy something from the other side of the world. Why would you do that? And I get the cost thing, but that then needs to be backed up by the government and to say, look, you know, we're supporting the rural economy. So I've gotten a bit on a high horse here.
No, well, it's so important. And if you ever spend time, you know, we live semi-rural, I would say, in terms of, you know, we're on the edge of a 1,000-acre farm. Not ours, I just hasten to add. But, you know, if you go deeper into rural communities where this is kind of more of a commuter belt, if you like, but the areas where people don't commute from, that's actually where they live and where they work. And you see the deprivation. You know, people think the countryside is all Land Rovers and, you know, wellies and shooting and
that's the
all
danger
that.
Of the warm bath approach, you
and
say, with Countryfile. That you actually,
And you do show that on Countryfile. You show those areas where it's hard. I was going to swear, but I can. It's my podcast. It's hard bloody work, you know. It's really hard work and it's hard to make it profitable. But it's also what comes through Countryfile is the passion people have for that way of life. And I think that is so important, that politicians making decisions about our futures regarding our health, our food and our countryside, you know, harness that passion. We talked about that a lot today with August and her passion and your passion. So,
and you know, we all love to go out and spend time in the countryside because it feels good, and it only looks the way that it looks because of British farmers. You know, if people didn't farm the land, it would look very, very different. And people wouldn't travel from all over the place to come and boost our tourism and all of that, because it wouldn't look like this.
Yeah, and you, when you travel around the world and other countries and kind of see kind of how they farm differently, you get these massive fields, you don't get the hedgerows, and you don't get, you know, all the things that we take for granted. And, you know, it's so different, say, if you went through the Midwest of America, where you would see acres and acres and acres and acres without grass on it even.
I actually did last year. I went and did a series called Travels in America, where I went into the rural parts of America and saw exactly what you're talking about there. And they, I mean, they're growing stuff in the desert. They're irrigating the Colorado River, pumping water out into the sand and literally growing crops in the sand. It's unbelievable how people are trying to utilize the land to grow stuff.
So this is clearly something that you'll never, it's always going to be with you, isn't it? Farming and the passion that you have for it will always be there. Well, whatever you do television-wise.
I think similar, you know, like Kenny, you know, when you grow up in it, it shapes you. I mean, it makes you who you are. And, you know, those early days of me off with my dog and doing what I was doing, I feel like that now. I mean, I don't feel older than that in my mind. I don't feel old. And I still love solving problems in the same way that I
do. Do you have a moment occasionally where you, although you don't feel old, you realise you are?
I see myself and think, I look old.
No.
Do you know what? No, but you know when you catch yourself, and that's the thing with telly, because you can't actually hide it. If you watch stuff, you go, God, I'm getting old.
No, you don't look old, but you look, you've grown up, haven't you? And you've grown up in the public gaze as well, to an extent, because, you know, you kind of started in telly as a boy.
Yeah. And well, weirdly, this year's my 25th year in telly, since I sent that video off to Blue Peter. And it's funny, really, because I was only looking back the other day and I was like, oh, I wonder what I was like there. And I found a clip on YouTube of my first ever Blue Peter. And I go, hello, my name is Matt and I'm from Durham. I sort of introduced myself like that. And I was like, wow, I was so young.
So you've said, I'm not going with that. There must be something else where you feel like, I mean, are you still doing backflips?
No, I can't now. I've injured my back. And this is, I tell you what.
Okay, here we go.
The thing. Yeah, exactly. This is midlife, talking about your experience, isn't it?
We started off, by the way, before we pressed record on this, and Matt was talking about his favourite tools. I decided to spare our dear listeners.
So true.
So tell us about your bad back.
Turned me back in. I was doing a panto and I was doing three Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and we were practicing with the stunt chairs, and the chair wasn't set correctly, and then bang, and I went down on my coccyx. Anyway, it's coccyx. And it turns out I slipped a disc in my back, and it's just, I've done everything I can to try and get it right, and like through training and rehab and everything. I've had to go do
you
the
live
injections
with a physio
thing. Yeah, I know, exactly.
So we tried an epidural, basically.
Went for the nerve block. And I mean, I can't tell you how upsetting it is as an ex-gymnast not to be able to bend forward. Do you know what I mean?
So you'll get that mobility back, though.
Well, I don't know. It's not, I mean, it doesn't hurt when I bend forward.
I was going to ask you if you could still do the splits, but if we can't bend forwards, Matt, then we're...
And that's where I'm at. And I'm trying my hardest to try and keep fit with a bad back. And those are the challenges as you get older.
Well, luckily, you can still run around the farm to keep fit, because that will keep you in a certain amount of shape, won't it? And by the sounds of it, you've got the food down. So that's good.
Yeah, and I still do. I mean, I know we've talked about insanity over the years, haven't we?
Yeah.
I do a version of that's what I do. In fact,
you
did it
can
this
do that
morning.
With your back.
Yeah, well, I have to sub out some exercises.
No, no jumping burpees.
No, the bending forwards become like pull-ups. Do you know what I mean? And but I'm trying. You have to do a lot more exercise as you hit midlife.
You do. You have to do a lot more, and more than you might think, and keep the strength up as well.
Yeah.
Being a gymnast, though, you've got good core body strength, so you just keep that ticking over.
So you're
in good shape. And what about when I used to occasionally dip into the One Show and do the odd show with you, you were into writing songs. You were writing
we've got a piano at home, and I haven't spent as much time as I was doing back then doing it, but I love it, and that's one of the things that allows me to sit down Mm. You know, I very rarely, I mean, we're doing it here, but I very rarely, and I'm quite fidgety and I'm quite sort of like...
And that makes you kind of hyper-focused, doesn't it?
It's productive sitting. Mm. As is art, I like to paint, and that's the same. You get a result at the end
of it. You're good at hobbies, you know. I think you might be the best hobby person we've had on the
I do. Well, I've got it. Like, when you don't read, what do you fill your time with?
True, yeah.
And if you spend all day doing telly, you're not going to sit down and watch telly. Mm. So there's emptiness there. See, like, I need to fill it. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to play something.
And you put some of your art on your Instagram account, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, thank you. I like learning as well.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
New skills. So where do you go to get your learning from? Do you go to YouTube or would you... Because if you're not reading...
Yeah, I often try it first without any sort of like any information at all. I see people and I get inspired by them and I think, I want to try that. And then I'll go and try it and then I'll think, right, I need a few pointers on this. So then I'll probably go and find someone and talk to them.
Well, you must have loved Strictly then because you're learning with the best.
Yeah. It was like going back to gymnastics.
Yeah.
It's the only way I can describe it. Well, and you'll know yourself. It's like that thing, isn't it, where you have a certain amount of time. You've got a performance at the end of the week. You're not learning to dance. You're just trying to do a routine.
As best as you can.
Yeah. Remember those steps. Put your leg into a certain position, your arm into a certain position, and then just repeat and just keep going until you don't get it wrong.
And were you tempted to keep dancing afterwards?
No. I was done. Well, because I don't... Did you learn to dance? I mean,
No. You're right. You don't actually learn to dance. You just learn the steps.
The routine.
The routine and the steps that you do on that particular show. So, yeah, you're right. You don't actually learn.
And then you turn up somewhere and everyone goes, oh, there's the Strictly girl. Do as a dance. And you're like, well, does anyone else know the same routine as me? Because we ain't doing anything if not. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I might be able to sway a bit.
At least Kenny got to do the one-armed lift on the Dirty Dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at least he got that. Because he could just at wedding and stuff. He just used to lift people up and literally people would come up to him and in restaurants and they go, could you do the one arm lift for me?
Yeah.
And he'd go, all right then. And to be honest with you, Matt, he couldn't. I mean, after about 5 weeks after the show, he didn't have the strength left.
No.
And I'd be looking at these poor women being thrust into the air thinking, we've got a lawsuit coming our way anytime soon on this.
But you two wouldn't be able to dance together because you both learned different routines.
Yeah, no way. Because we got asked regularly by charities, could you come to our charity event and do a dance for us? Well, no, we never danced together. Yeah. So, you know, and as he'd tell you, he danced for 7 weeks longer than me.
People don't understand. They think you go and learn. Like, I don't know if people think you go to dance university for an entire year before you turn up. No, they go, put your arm there, move your leg there and just do it a few times and then we'll move on.
And if you're quite good at hearing the beat, you'll get it quicker. If you're quite good at moving your body, you'll hear it quicker.
What petrified me is when you used to go in and hear the band, because you're learning to a tape, aren't you? And it was often like the singer of the song that you were, so it was like the pop version.
And
you
turn on
Dave Archer's there with his band and you walk in, you're like, what on earth are they playing? It's like, that's your song?
Yeah.
I was like, no.
It's a totally different thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously better, but it's not what you were practicing
to. Well, no, because you're going to do a little move on the guitar riff that doesn't exist in Dave Archer's version.
So your fearlessness, it would seem to me, is as healthy as ever. Mm. Your bravery and your ability to kind of turn your hand to something new, which you've always been brilliant at in midlife, seems to be thriving, which is great. And the challenges are all still out there for you.
I hope that's the one thing that doesn't fade. I was filming with a group of pensioners last week and they were in their 70s and they were trying to open up a tunnel in Wales in the Rhondda Valley. And I thought to myself, they want to make it the longest cycling and walking tunnel in Europe.
Okay.
And it's an old Victorian tunnel.
And it's been blocked.
Yeah. And they're trying to unblock it and raise all this money. And I looked at these lads and I thought, I hope I'm like you when I'm 70. They've become my new inspiration. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like the passion to do a project like that. Yeah.
And just, you know, doing stuff because it's good to do. Mm. And you're doing it for other people, doing it for the community, and you're having a great time together.
And why were you filming that?
Oh, it's for a new series. Another, I can't tell you about.
another bloody show.
Yeah, another show. Yeah, but we should do some shows.
We should.
I tell you what, I've thought of a few while we've been sat here, but I'm not going to announce them on the microphone. When it's turned off, I'll tell you.
He's a show machine. Yeah. Life's good by the sounds of it, and really, really excited for Nicola as well. So please pass on my regards, and also best of luck with her books. I can't wait to get my hands on them, actually. I've got lots of... my kids are a bit older than them, but I've got nieces and nephews, so I'll be out there.
You can have the full set.
Oh, thank you very much. Signed, I hope, as well.
Oh, no doubt about it. First editions.
Matt, it's great to see you, and great to have you on the Midpoint. Thank you so, so much. I had such a lovely time chatting with Matt, or the Northeast version of Crocodile Dundee, as I'll refer to him from now on. And I loved hearing about all the adventures he's had throughout his career and how now, in midlife, he's reaping the rewards of those bold moves towards the things he loves. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might also like to go back and check out my episode with Matt's fellow Countryfile presenter, Juliet Bradbury, which was a favourite of mine. Thank you also to August Bernstein for more gardening and veg growing tips. You can follow her on Instagram at augusts_garden. That's AUGUSTS_garden. And now all that remains for me is to thank Spiritland Creative for putting this episode together, and to you for listening. I hope you can join me again next Wednesday. Take care.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.